Dan here with a quick update before we get into the episode. After we recorded these next 2 weeks' episodes, the entire series Unsub was uploaded to YouTube. So if you want to watch the episodes before you listen to us talk about them, just go to YouTube, search for user CanelFan4587, that's C-A-N-N-E-L-L fan, 4587, or you can just search for Unsub, White Bone Demon. Either way, you should get to the playlist without too much trouble and be able to watch the whole show for yourself. Now, take it away, me in the past.
Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Sheila.
And today we're taking a break from the titular show to talk about one of the antecedents? Like, one of the things that led us there to Criminal Minds in a oblique and roundabout way.
Well, I'm not so sure. Like I sit here and go, this is the antecedent. I don't think there
is
anything.
It's true. It is very close. It's very close.
As far as TV is concerned, it is the antecedent to.
It's the most direct inspiration we're likely to say for Criminal Minds, and that is the show Unsub, which is not a good title for a show.
Well, no, but. You know, you could say Manhunter wasn't necessarily.
Are you kidding? Manhunter's an amazing title. Do you know how many things there have been that have been called Manhunter?
Yes, I know.
It's a really popular title. People love that title. No, Unsub's a terrible title. I'm just saying, had this show been called Criminal Minds, it'd run for 5 years. That's an exaggeration.
Yeah, but he calls his shows weird things. This is a show conceived of by Stephen J. Cannell. We already talked last episode a lot about that. But
yeah,
he does have some weird names for his shows.
Every now and then, yeah. It's true that, I mean, Wise Guy's a pretty good name.
But Silk Stockings?
No, Silk Stockings spelled stalk with a S-T-A-L-K. That's not a very good title.
No,
although even that lasted a couple of years. But 18. Unsub is 18 no, what?
Only 18 episodes,
I think. Oh. Wow. Okay. I am surprised then.
Something like that.
But the point is, Unsub is a notably terrible name for a TV show. And I think that's just fair to say. It's not a good title.
Yeah. Except that everybody who has written reviews does remember it fondly.
Well, that's good to know. And, I assume we are the 9th and 10th person to have seen the show.
Yeah. We didn't see it in the beginning, right?
No, we didn't. I mean, this show flew way under the radar. So it came out, and you said 1989?
February the 3rd, 1989.
Okay.
And, it was on for 8 episodes. It was on CBS. So,
that's very interesting. Just the idea that it was happening right alongside Wise Guy.
And I'm going, okay, 1989. So that was the year I had 3 things published. It was a notable year for me. I'm going, I don't know why. Was it on against something else?
That must be it. I mean, I'm sure we can do some research before next week and find out when we talk about the second 8 episodes. And we'll find out, like, what it was up against, what its airtime was. But it's like, you watch this show and it is... I mean, there have always been mature shows on television. There have even always been dark shows on television. But this show is just... It is rough right from the start.
Yeah, and I think that it's... Like, there are other shows like this where you watch them and you can see, why they're not catching on. I mean, this is still the tail end of the... 80s, right?
Yeah, it's the very end of the 80s.
And moving into the 90s, and the 90s were still not... the 90s gave us CSI, right?
Well, the late 90s. I mean, the definitive cop show of the 1990s was NYPD Blue, where David Milch's attempt to do a more gritty and realistic Hill Street Blues. That is like the most 90s TV show is that. And then, of course, the end of the 90s gave us CSI, which would go on to define the look and feel of a lot of television for the next 10 years. Although it's interesting, Some would say the definitive cop show of the 90s was The X-Files, but I guess that I consider it to be slightly more into, you know, sci-fi supernatural. But its core, it is a cop show as well.
Yeah.
I think that's safe to say. Because it follows that same structure of you open with a crime, and then they find out about the crime, and then they go to the location, and blah, 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 blah. Like, it's pretty by the numbers.
Yeah, it just tests this alien side of
the alien twist.
And it has the smoking man.
Yes. And you have a guy who's responsible for all the crimes dropping by every few episodes to just be very sinister.
Yeah.
Whereas in this show, all of the crimes are caused by bad parenting.
Yeah, and it makes absolutely no
qualms, no hesitation.
There's a whole stack of things it has no hesitation about.
No, and so let's go for it with the first episode, Bone White Demon.
Yeah, with Paul Guilfoyle, who then became a CSI Las Vegas, the original CSI cop.
That's true. He's the cop on CSI Las Vegas.
Yeah.
More significantly, I guess on the strength of his performance in this episode, in season 2 of Wise Guy, he would play an incredibly memorable white supremacist.
Yes.
In a fantastic story arc in season 2 of Wise Guy, probably because they saw him in this episode and they're like, let's bring him back because, oof! All right, so the episode takes place... I'm trying to remember what city it takes place in. Oh, that's embarrassing. It takes place in a city.
I don't think it matters.
No, it doesn't really matter where it is. And there are murders. Women are being murdered on Friday night in their home. And the team has to rush over there to figure out who's doing it and why. And... It's a fairly by the numbers story. It's interesting because they show up, they go through, you know, the basics of what profiling is, which is nice. Like, we get a little primer in the basics of what profiling is, and they give us the background, and then they follow leads in a direct copy of the movie Manhunter.
Yeah, they follow him. They figure it out. No, to talk about the show, right?
It is interesting how directly copied it is from Manhunter.
Well, I would assume that was. I mean, I suppose Cannell, it was his, the inspiration. Okay, for Unsub,
obviously.
You have to assume that's obvious. And you can tell it just by the opening sequences, by the music, Everything, right? That there is an influence. And I think that had Manhunter done better,
this would have done better as well.
Unsub would have done better. Yeah.
I think that's a fair thing to suggest. I think you're probably right about that.
You know, I mean, Manhunter and was like, we look at it now
and we say that's one of the best movies in the 1980s. But at the time, it was like they couldn't give away tickets to Manhunter.
Yeah, and yet and of course William Peterson from Manhunter shows up on CSI.
That's true. He would also go on to be the star of CSI. So yeah, I mean, they come by all this stuff honestly.
All these interconnections, but I think I think what struck me with White Bone Demon, like, this doesn't have for me the same kind of screaming heebie-jeebies that Criminal Minds does periodically.
Really?
Well, no, I get so mad at Criminal Minds.
You do.
Yeah.
This one was much easier to take.
Well, no, this is partly because... okay, I'm a fan of British TV.
Okay, right? Totally normal.
Okay, now, why I can't remember the name of the 30, it's practically 30 years now, running CSI show in Britain.
Prime Suspect?
No.
Silent Witness.
Yeah. I think it's, is it Silent
Witness? Yeah, Silent Witness. It's the show about the coroners, CSI people.
The CSI people, okay?
Yeah.
But what I really appreciated about White Bone Demon, well, when they introduced, like, profiling, when the cop asks him, and he, why they wear all of these, because that drives me crazy.
Yeah.
Right. Do these guys are constantly in Criminal Minds contaminating the
just walking around the crime scene all the time. And he gets that wonderful story about finding his wife's hair at a crime scene.
Yeah. Yeah. They have they find a hair. I mean, it was a brilliant way of explaining
the importance of that kind of forensic thing.
Of why they're wearing these suits, why they're wearing these booties, why they cover their faces.
Yeah.
Completely so they don't contaminate. And, of course, Silent Witness, that's just classic.
Yeah, I don't know. That's what they've always done.
There is no high heels
in Silent Witness. Or Silent Witness. And there's actually, in Unsub too, but what's the neatest thing in the episode is that they build a frame over the crime scene. So that they can walk around the crime scene without contaminating anything. And that is a level of detail going into, you know, how this forensic work can be done that is not represented in any subsequent episode. But seeing it in the pilot, it really does set the tone of the kind of professionalism you're looking at. And it does a great job of introducing how these people work, even if they don't keep that up in subsequent episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do it. There's a fun scene where they call from the plane to say, go down to a hardware store and buy this and buy all of this lumber and construction supplies. We'll tell you why when we get there. And, you know, I mean, on some level, is that kind of just a power play from the FBI? Sure. Because you could have told them why they needed to do it. But at the same time, I really like it because it just does show they have this method and they're not interested in, they have this method, they have this way of doing things. They're not interested in explaining it to anyone because they have too much to worry about without having to worry about other people's, I'm not going to say emotions necessarily, but like the way things are done in the local cops' jurisdictions.
Yeah, and I think, you see, and here it makes a lot more sense than it does in Criminal Minds 20 years later.
Yeah.
You know, because here, what they're doing is still new.
Yeah.
Because, as I told you, I have read Roger Dupuis. Well, yeah, but it's, and never mind. I don't know how they pronounce it in the
States. Doesn't matter. Just keep going.
Right? And he resigned. Like he retired in 1989. Yeah. I suspect I mentioned, I mean, they must have talked to him about this when they were setting all of this up. And certainly David Soule comes across as
that kind of figure,
a decent type boss, but like a real organizational boss.
Yeah.
And it's the whole episode is, as you say, pretty straightforward. There's none of this. Here they don't. Well, we'll talk about this, but they do actually go and get warrants and things, you know?
Yeah, we do actually hear about them getting warrants, which is nice.
Which is nice. It's like
after years of Criminal Minds of them kicking down whoever's door whenever.
Yeah, and they just manage to do it fast enough or get it, you know, ahead of time or, you know what they're going to need. But White Bone Demon, but I think it was too creepy.
It's an incredibly creepy hour of television.
That first episode is like when you stand back and go, okay, 1989. So what are we looking at? 10 Speed and Brown Shoe, Stone, The Greatest American Hero, The A-Team.
Well, those are all earlier 80s, but yes.
No. But even Hunter, Stingray, The Last Precinct.
These are action. These are action cop shows.
21 Jump Street. J.J. Starbuck. And you throw in Unsub?
Yeah.
Into you're the absolutely 80s? Right. And it is a grim, grim show. I mean, even though you don't see the killings.
Yeah.
Which
they
really
keep that entirely off screen. It is nice. Like,
yeah, you don't need it.
Considering the gruesomeness we see in later TV shows and like the focus on Viscera here, it's just so eerie without doing any of that.
You don't have to do any of that. You know, you have it's what this is noir television.
Absolutely.
This is to me one of the highlights of this particular show is Emmett Walsh, right?
Oh, isn't he fantastic playing old cop on the team?
Yeah, but to me he is still Blood Simple.
Yeah, he's still the private eye from Blood Simple. Oh.
Which
if you haven't seen that, it's the Coen brothers' first movie and it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's
that's a rough one.
Noir.
Oh yeah.
And that's what this is. This is noir television, which you don't really is never talked about when you read about noir television, because you don't really have much in the way of what I would call noir television, except the Danes and some of the Europeans are doing a little bit of it. But
oh no, they still do. Like, you still get your bleak detective shows out of Europe.
Yeah, and this is really bleak, but it's showing you how they do things, how they figure out why he's doing it Friday nights so the bodies aren't found till Mondays.
Yeah.
And then, as they say, so he can go back and seek forgiveness. And, you know, and you just, you can follow their kind of logic, but you also have your only female on the team.
Yeah.
And she does a good job, but you have her having all of these problems, right?
Yeah, questions about whether she can keep doing it, and yeah, she's the one who's hesitant about what this kind of stuff, like what inviting this stuff into your life causes.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting is she is because she does the psychological stuff, but she's also a nurse.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that I had just read Candace DeLong's. She was one of the first women who ever worked in the BAU as well. Yeah.
And was she a medical professional as well?
She was a nurse. She went into the FBI and then she illegally did nursing on the side.
Oh my God.
Because she needed more money because the FBI didn't pay very well. And this would have been in the 80s as well. So I suspect that they modified her.
That must have been the inspiration for her.
Yeah. Because
it's such a weird character detail to put in there.
Yeah.
If it wasn't based on a real person.
And that's so funny. I mean, reading these different biographies that came out, oh, the late 90s, the 2000s, the early 2000s, there was a whole slew of them that came out.
Right.
But yeah, so it's, and I think that you have the David Soul character, the leader of the team, mm-hmm. handling these things, discussing them well. You know, like I'm kind of, like I see the series as a whole, so I'm kind of forgetting where he does what. But, you know, he talks about how his own marriage failed.
Yeah. Well, he does that a little later on when she's talking about splitting up with a guy.
Yeah.
Her boyfriend left her because, you know, she always put the job first. And he's like, I always put the job first and it cost me my first marriage.
Yeah.
And he has a good story about that.
Yeah.
But the funny thing about, just to focus on the first episode for a second, what I found kind of interesting in it is, again, like it's wonderful to watch the profiling, right? And them thinking about what it could mean. And you have a guy literally doing the William Peterson scene from Manhunter. Like the guy who, I think they would have gone into more focus on this character and why he's so screwed up by empathizing with serial killers. And that turns him into a wreck of a person. I think that would have developed over the course of the show. But because I've just, of course, seen glimpses in these first four episodes of it. And watching him do that. So they do all of that. But fundamentally, what catches this killer is Emmett Walsh's looking at her notebook, like her address book, and being like, someone tore out the K page. Let's just write down all of the businesses. There's only business in a row. Let's look at her phone book, see what page was recently open, write down all the businesses with K names. Yeah.
Well, but that's the whole point with this, right? Is that Emmett Walsh is this old-time cop, and he says sometimes it's just the old-time cop stuff. Remember how they're all – like this is – that takes into consideration that you can meld these together.
Yeah.
Like, it's not as if the profiling is the whole thing. That's the one thing that you do get here. Profiling is not the whole answer.
No.
To how you can get these serial killers, right? Because it's the old thing. They're worried about the window.
Yeah. Someone breaks through the window. Nice scene.
And so, of course, Emmett Walsh just goes out and asks the cop,
You open the window?
Well, sometimes you hear that and you kind of want to throw up and the rest of it. And did you open the window?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So he goes back to it and says, don't worry about the window. The cop opened it, right?
Yeah, it's not actually evidence. He didn't sneak in.
Nothing.
Yeah.
No, he didn't sneak in.
He walked in the front door and he was let in. And I was Emmett Walsh, you're fantastic.
But what it tells you is that the show is saying that cops have a role to play in this.
But let's
just go to the Derek character, please. I thought that at the beginning I killed myself laughing. That's how it opens up, and then it gets so bleak. But it opens up, and he tells him, right? Because if Sky is going to be late for work again, he's missed getting to where he's supposed to go.
Yeah.
Right? And so he sends him off to the conductor. And when he gets to the orchestra, he says, ask him for a job.
That's so beautiful. It's a very funny scene.
It was a very funny opening scene. And I thought, the irresponsible playboy type.
Yep.
But of course.
It's because he's the guy whose job it is to, and this is what I'm saying, they could have done a lot with him going forward, because he's the guy whose job it is to do the Will Graham thing and completely empathize with a serial killer.
You know what?
And that is going to take a lot of toll on you as a person.
Yeah. You know what the funny thing is?
Is that
I think that when Jeff Davis initially got this idea and put this show together, Criminal Minds, that he must have seen Unsubbed when he was a kid.
Well, not a kid. I mean, he wasn't a young man when he made
Criminal Minds.
But still, yes. But when he was younger, it wouldn't surprise me if he had seen this show.
If he hadn't seen this, and because if you go back to the first season of Criminal Minds, Derek does more of the profiling. From the walking around of the scenes and stuff. So that changes
as the show goes on. But yeah, he does do a lot of it to start with.
At the beginning, even in Ride the Lightning.
That's true.
He goes in and stuff. So you see him, I think he was structured more to be the Tony character in Unsub.
Yeah, originally, and then they pulled back on that.
Yeah, they pulled back on that.
That's interesting. I think you could be right about that. But yeah, it's a great character introduction, and I see why your first thought would be like, this is their Derek Morgan.
Yeah, this is your Derek Morgan, right?
Yeah.
Because it was just,
he's reckless in the same way, he's a womanizer in the same way, and this guy is troubled in a different way than Derek, and the show, I think, is more open about the fact that this guy is troubled than Criminal Minds ever is with Derek.
And the boss handles it differently.
Oh, yeah, completely differently.
Completely differently. And, the boss here of this team is definitely the stabilizing influence.
Well, he's much stricter with his team than Aaron is. Like, that's the thing. Like, Aaron is not that strict with his team. He is more willing to let them go off on their flights of fancy and such, and he gives them so much rope. Yeah. Whereas this guy, he really does. He is a taskmaster. He does keep people in line.
Yeah.
Like, that is his whole thing. And I'm not saying he's necessarily he's obviously a better boss than Aaron is.
Because just remember, Criminal Minds has the conceit that Mandy Patinkin, Gideon.
Yeah.
Is the boss of that team.
Yeah.
So technically, Aaron doesn't have the same authority that he should have, that David Soul has.
That even, you're right, because on some level, even after Mandy leaves, and it is Aaron's team, the team still doesn't see him as the boss as much.
Yeah.
Because that's not how they were first introduced to him, and it's hard to get that out of your head. Yeah. I think that, yeah, that is part of it, isn't it? Whereas here, David Soul is, there's no question. He's the older guy. He's the boss of the team. He's the one running things. He's the one essentially trying to prove the whole usefulness of profiling, which is something we're going to get into in episode two. But let's just focus on the killer in episode one for a second before we move on, which is, so yeah, he's just a twisted, guy who was horribly abused by his mother for his entire life, and now he has killed women as a result. And in a nice thing they miss in profiling, right? There's a thing where, like, why does he mess up their feet? Like, why does he cut them in the feet? And they find out that he's got a trick where he has a woman put on a shoe, and it's got a razor blade in the sole to distract them, and so he can stab them while they're incapacitated from that. But of course, what they don't really get, well, they don't predict, and the show doesn't really mention, is he's got a bad limp on that foot.
Yeah.
He's got a screwed up foot from this time that his mother brutalized him as a child. And he can't walk right because his leg didn't heal right. And it's like, and that's the same foot he's screwing up on the women. And it's just this interesting note that's only there for you, the audience.
Yeah. It's, yeah, and you have to pick up on it.
Yeah, you have to pay attention.
Yeah.
And then his mother kills him. Jesus, this show.
She's such an evil.
She's such a monster.
She is truly a monster. That woman was just a monster, and she did it so well.
Yeah, such a good performance. She's only got two scenes in the episode, but you're like, oh, I know exactly where this, like, it's so well written and so well acted. Like, I know exactly where this guy is coming from.
And what has been done and the whole thing, right? Like, and it doesn't have to be laid out.
Nope.
You can figure it out. Like,
yeah.
And you can't, this, what I would say about this show is that this show, more than Criminal Minds, could give you nightmares.
Yeah. This one could stick with you.
You know, and I have a feeling that that's why it didn't take off.
Well, because Criminal Minds, like, yeah, they'll have some bleak endings every now and then, but they always have that thing at the end of the episode where, look, they do the story structure thing where at the end of the episode, look, the family's all back together and they're all heading home on the plane, and now they're talking about, you know, stuff in their personal lives and what they learned about the situation. And, oh, here's a trite quote to end some music to end it out on.
Yeah. Yeah, so that, and this show has none of that.
No, this does not give you that denouement after it's over. Like, it does not let you off the hook at the end of the episode.
Yeah, it doesn't have the short story ending.
No, it really doesn't. Like, it really doesn't. So, yeah, and then, of course, his mother talks him into killing himself because, you know, she does not want to deal with the hassle of all of this.
She doesn't want to be ashamed. She doesn't want to have to go to trial. She doesn't want to have to,
visit, yeah, like, ask people why she's not visiting him in prison.
Yeah.
Because she would definitely never visit him in prison. Like, that's just a gimme. So she badgers him into killing himself, and it works, because, Jesus! Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a woman, and they actually point out at the end of the episode that it's like, I wish we could have arrested the mother.
Yeah.
Like, she's the one who caused all of this.
And they all know it. Yeah.
And they all know it. And she turned him into a monster. All right. So the second episode, right away, tells the entire story of Elle in one episode.
In one episode. This and is
it took them like 20, 30 episodes to do on Criminal Minds. They do in one episode on Unsub.
One episode.
All right. So the team takes a trip to Vancouver, British Columbia, which is funny because they're pretty good about how the cops work. But at one point they're like, they talk about the British Columbia police. And I'm like, no, Vancouver has a police department. This isn't some small town in the middle of nowhere where the provincial cops have to handle it. Like, it's the Vancouver police. If I were to go to, like, Atlanta and try to solve a crime, I wouldn't say the Texas police have their way of doing things. No, it's like it's the Atlanta PD. And then the same way, Vancouver's a huge city, which there's actually something else about their treatment of Vancouver that I'll mention in a second. But let's focus on the episode.
And it's raining.
And it's raining. And it's raining the whole time. And that is very Vancouver. I will give them that. It is raining constantly in Vancouver.
I think the whole location, I think all eight of them were done in Vancouver.
Oh, that wouldn't surprise me. Canelle loved shooting in Vancouver. That yeah. I know. But yeah, so they head out there to solve the crime of a kid who has been murdered. And what's interesting is they immediately know, right? I like this about it. They're like, yeah, once a pedophile starts killing kids, he's not going to stop killing kids. Mm-hmm. You know? And in one of the most upsetting things, and by the way, it's a show about how it's a note to how the show can be both incredibly upsetting and much more restrained than Criminal Minds, because we hear the letter that the killer sent to the parents.
Yes.
And it is horrible because it's blaming them for not looking after their kid better.
Yeah.
Like, it's a horrible, monstrous thing for the killer to have done. Over and above murdering their child, he then sends the parents a letter blaming them for their dead child. It's like, if you had just watched him better, I wouldn't have had to do this. It's nightmarish. But then, and this is so amazing, they don't go and see the parents. Like, Criminal Minds always tries to, like, ratchet all of the grief pornography out of seeing the families of these dead people. Not always, but enough that it's notable that that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
But this is two episodes in a row, and that's going to continue for subsequent episodes, except for one detour into the characters' private lives, where we don't spend any time with the families of the victims at all.
No.
Like, we do not intrude on their grief. And, I mean, David Soule specifically says, like, there's nothing we need to bring to the parents. Like, they've been through enough. They don't need to talk to us. I'm like, wow. Yeah. That is so strange. It's so unusual. Right? Like, it is so weird to see them doing that in a show, to not take the time to be like, let's just luxuriate in people's grief and sorrow and agony at the loss of their child. Because so many shows have done that. Yeah. Hell, there's an episode of Criminal Minds where, like, a parent gets murdered by the grief over the death of their child.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, and this is ultimately what he's trying to do, Canelle, is this is more realistic because the FBI doesn't essentially do this, because these are all local situations. The local police take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've already done that. I mean, it was just a friend thing that brought them into Vancouver.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about the Vancouver case is they specifically say that this is a crime from a couple of months ago. Like, mm-hmm. it's the nearest thing to a cold case. Mm-hmm. And that's why they think it's safe for the L character to go look on it rather than just work on. We should make it clear. We're talking about an L character. There is a M. Emmett Walsh knows this policewoman and thinks she's talented and thinks she possibly has what it takes to do this kind of work. So he is bringing her in to study with the team. And the practice is you should spend your first few months just profiling cold cases, just going over old stuff that they've already solved to see how they work and do that. But she wants to get out of the field right away. And they figure, well, this guy's been dormant for 3 months. Maybe it's safe to bring her along. And M. Emmett Walsh vouches for her.
Yeah.
And so she comes to Vancouver with them. And of course it all goes horribly awry.
Yeah, and in that sense, she is very much the L character, and that, you know, comes in as a cop and
wants to move up right away to do this kind of job. Like, thinks she's ready right away, and is undone by the fact that she just hates these people so much.
Yeah,
and L has, of course, more of a reason for that because she gets shot. But this woman, you completely understand where she's coming from. Because, again, you give us... This is their most cartoonishly evil villain in the four episodes I've seen. Like, the other three characters we see are completely broken by childhood abuse. Right? All three of... That's going to come up in the next two episodes we talk about as well. But this guy, we don't know anything about this guy. Except that he's a children's clown who loves murder. And it's like, they're like, no, for this guy, to make it clear why she would rather see this guy dead, right? Why she would rather see this guy dead than arrested. Like, the show has to shortcut us there by making him as monstrous and as possible. And while the other three villains we see in these four episodes are completely grounded characters, this guy's just crazy.
Mm-hmm. Like, and you could say...
Yes.
Mm-hmm. No, go on.
I was just going to say, like, he literally drives around in a car wearing full clown makeup, abducting and raping and murdering children. Wow.
Yeah. With his rabbit.
With his rabbit to lure them. Oh my God.
Yeah, and we don't need, what you see, we don't get the backstory, and this would be what would happen. They wouldn't get the backstory because it's in Vancouver. It's in another country.
Yeah, they don't have time to find out.
Yeah, they're just coming up to see if there's anything that they can help. And it's not even the whole team. It's just three members of the team.
Yeah. Which is a nice touch. I mean, we still get the rest of the team in there because they send forensic stuff back to base.
Oh, God, and the married couple.
Oh, the married couple who runs the forensic team.
It was so good. Like the
They're
first
very
episode,
entertaining.
They just came back from their honeymoon. Yeah. And then in this episode, as I said, what's interesting, I mentioned this to you, right, is that their computer specialist is also a woman.
Yeah.
Right?
She doesn't have the same kind of role that Penelope does, but it is notable.
Yeah. And she can't because,
no, of course not.
I mean, you see what she does but she still does all of this fancy schmancy stuff with her computer. And in 1989.
Yeah. It's a much different deal. Yeah.
You know, but she's still doing this. I mean, you look at the sets and the rest of it compared to now. Right. But and a lot of stuff isn't on computer anyway.
That's true.
But there she is, you know, working with her pixels. Right. And then they get that pixel picture. Right. Of the guy. Yep. And they kind of go,
well, this isn't going to be useful. It's completely useful, like,
yeah.
How useful this possibly be? It's a black and white image of a weirdo with, you know, with black lips and white skin. Obviously, the computer did this wrong. And, of course, the joke is, we later find out that, no, he was wearing my makeup.
Yeah, he was wearing his
makeup. That is, in fact, exactly what he looks like. There's a hilarious scene after the guy is, well, hilarious. It's dark, too. The Vancouver cop has shot this guy. Like, the car drives at him, and he shoots the guy in the face.
Yeah.
And it's very upsetting. Right? And it's very upsetting, and he's worried that he has killed the wrong guy.
Yeah.
And they get to his apartment. It's like, oh no, he had my makeup on.
You got the right guy. Take a look at this picture with its pixels, right? With its Pac-Man pixels.
Yeah.
with its giant
Pac-Man pixels.
Yeah. And they have that forensic team, but they do more of the forensic stuff. So As a team, you know, that works as well. But
You're right. They're a full crime-solving organization. There's psychology, there's forensics, there's old-fashioned detective work all in one team, rather than it just being profilers who are also good at everything else.
Yeah. And it was very interesting to watch, too. So this is 1989. You would never see this today, right? But Emmett Walsh, I mean, just slaps her across the face. And then feels so guilty about it because he knows he shouldn't. He doesn't know whether he feels guilty about it because it's a woman or because he knows he shouldn't do it anymore. This is something he would have done 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And he explains all of that. But it's because, first of all, she showed up in Canada with a gun.
Yep.
And you're not allowed to bring guns across the border.
Nope.
That was number one. So how the hell did she have a gun? She brought her. So he's pissed off about
that. Well,
they
didn't search her luggage because she's a cop.
Well, yeah. And that was 1989. Remember, this is pre 9/11.
Yep.
And she's a cop. Yeah, she's an FBI agent. Plus, she doesn't work as a team. She went out and did all this stuff on her own.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, she calls this guy
And that's the key element. So when she, they're at the, they figured this kid had to be abducted on his way to the
music lesson.
So when they go to the music lesson, when they go to talk to the music teacher, they actually spot the guy trolling for his next victim.
Yeah.
Outside. And instead of telling people that she sees him, and telling the team that she sees him and letting them go down to surround and arrest the guy, she goes down herself to try and shoot the guy herself.
Yeah. And then after that, she finds him and she phones him rather than allowing.
She knows the cops are going. Yeah, she knows the cops are going to get, are waiting, and they're waiting for warrants to go and get him. And so she phones him and says, the cops are coming to arrest you, because she knows that'll make him run. It'll probably get him killed. And that is, in fact, exactly what happens. And in a scene that, again, I was going to point this out. I said I was going to point this out. There's a... they completely misunderstanding what kind of city Vancouver is. We see her making the phone call before getting on a tiny seaplane. I'm like, why are you getting on a tiny seaplane? Like, she's on a dock, and there's this floating plane, a plane floating on pontoons that carries, like, six people. And that's the plane she's going to use to fly back to Virginia. Like, no, there's a major international airport in Vancouver. It's Vancouver. It's one of the biggest cities in North America.
Yeah, I know. Even in 1989.
They're like, yeah, it's Canada. So it's just like this small outpost in the middle of... No, that's not Canada at all. And that's certainly not Vancouver.
Now, I thought it was pretty funny. You could have understood that in Wise Guy if David had gone off in that episode, the little profiling thing that you put up, right?
Yes, exactly. That kind of town, sure.
Sure, but not here.
Vancouver? No, not so much.
I'm not even sure where you'd find a dock like that or close to Vancouver.
No. I mean, maybe somewhere out on Vancouver Island. Who knows? But yeah. It's...
Yeah, but Vancouver Island is an entirely different city. That's Victoria.
I know. Yeah.
So, and a completely different place, and you'd have to take a boat to get there. You still have to take a boat to get there.
I know. It's funny. It is mildly funny, though. But yeah, and so she – and what I loved about it was that, like – the response was not the weird Pat Criminal Minds thing of, if I could prove it, I'd throw you in jail. It's, you can't be a cop anymore.
Yeah.
And that's the only punishment.
Yeah.
Like, I understand why you did this. I understand that this is hard, but you can't be a cop anymore.
You can't. No. You, yeah. And that's it. Done.
And that's it. That, you know. And that's good. Like, that's actually how the FBI treats this sort of thing. Like, when someone has this kind of a problem, when somebody, you know, roughs up someone too much, they police themselves. They don't send anybody to jail, but they're like, you can't do the job anymore. And that's that.
That's it. You're done.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, you know, and so then their end run at this show is just Emmett Walsh sort of, you know, kind of going, geez, but I shouldn't have hit her.
Yeah. Oh, and it's
well done, you know.
It's rough watching him. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Because he's going through this, you know, this isn't the job anymore.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's a different world. She's a different person. This isn't the 70s. Yeah. You know, this isn't when I came up as a tough city cop. This is a whole different world. And it's like, and just the idea that, like, he thinks that it's, you know, he could have just slapped a guy. And get him back on track. But there was more going on with her. This isn't just someone who lost focus for a minute.
Yeah. No, and she doesn't. Because she doesn't learn.
Yeah.
She doesn't learn. And
it's tough.
It has no impact. Yeah. I mean, that's what I said. This was a dark show. It's no wonder this thing got.
Yeah. Got canned immediately.
Yeah.
I get it.
It was, but that episode too, like I'm watching this, if there's one thing I could say, right from the beginning, you have a whole bunch of actors that manage to work pretty tightly together. Like,
that's
it's
true.
Well put together, right from the beginning, all of these different, you know, you have to allow for the end of the 80s, but
of course,
you know, and the norms for TV at the time. But at the same time, this is a team that works, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And don't screw up. Don't screw
up. No, that's true. Like, they work well together. They don't do these, they don't have those kinds of screw-ups. Like, they're all professional people.
Yes. You know? They're all professionals. They've all been through the FBI training. And, of course, that's the problem with the L character. And I said this about L, but here it is stark. It is done tightly. She didn't have the FBI training.
No, she didn't have the training to do this.
To do this job. And this is just, and this is what happens when you don't have the proper training.
Yeah, you're not ready for the things you're going to see.
Because this is a tough, tough, tough business that the BSU, the BAU, whatever you want to call it, it does. Because they just focus in on these horrible, horrible, limited crimes.
Which is why we get that nice note in the episode where they're talking to a senator trying to explain why they need the funding. Which is, it's like, yeah, you say it cost us $25 million to arrest 18 people. And I'm like, BAU's never arrested 18 people. But that's a whole other thing. But to identify 18 people, but those 18 people had 500 victims.
Yes.
So as a cost per victim, that's actually a pretty low number.
Yeah. I like it. No.
It's a good scene.
And I like that. That scene was very good, justifying how they justified. And this is why I say they had to have talked to Roger Dupuis, because that's what he was doing. Like, he was never, that's the only little thing. Dupuis talks about this in his book. He seldom went into the field.
Yeah.
It was only every now and then that he would go into.
He was mostly handling the paperwork, handling the management, handling the brass.
Handling the team.
Yeah.
You know, from whatever. Yeah.
Well, yes, because in real life, you need a guy back at base handling the team, because in real life, you don't send six people out there. You only ever send, there's a couple of people over here, there's a couple of people over there, blah, 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 blah. Like, there's not a giant investigative team going out. Yeah. You need someone coordinating everything and always being on top of what everybody is doing at all across the country where they're visiting places.
Yeah, remind me to send you. I scanned in the one chapter from the book, so remind me to send it up to you. Just the chapter about the BAU where he talks about all of the different people, like Douglas and Hazelwood and Wrestler and the rest of it. And it's actually very nice. Their specializations. He also talks about how some people just couldn't handle it.
Right.
And they would move into other areas. Related, but they couldn't handle sort of the stuff that they particularly did for any length of time.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, and then they would go on to head other parts of the FBI.
That's interesting. So they're still the best of the best, but they just, this job takes too much out of people.
Yeah, it takes out, and some people just can't do it. And
sorry, it's just... I just watched on the first season of Law & Order Sex Crimes where Dean Winters plays the cop who is just like, has to be told that, not everybody can do sex crimes.
Yeah.
Like, not everybody can do this work. It is just too demanding on people. And then that being said, apparently Olivia's been there for 25 years at this point. She seems fine.
Well, she's had her moments.
She's had her moments. There you go. All right, so the third episode is the big one to focus on, and you can tell people why.
It's Clean Slate, and for the love of me, I can't remember. You have to tell me.
It stars... Who does it star?
Clean Slate?
Yes. I'm kind of embarrassed for you right now.
Oh, wait a minute. Is Clean Slate the one that stars
it's Kevin Spacey episode. It's the Kevin.
I was getting there.
I know, but we're not going to make people listen to you guessing.
Okay. But no. I would have gotten there because I remembered when I watched this, because I didn't watch it with titles. Like, I didn't pay attention.
That's fine.
Although Daddy Dearest, I do. Anyway, Clean Slate. I mean, and I watched Kevin Spacey and I went,
such a tragedy.
It's such a tragedy.
Why does he have to be such a scumbag?
Why did he have to be? Well, I kind of guessed. It's not a huge surprise. I hate to say it, you know. I hate to say it about all the scumbaggy things he did.
Yeah.
Uh, in the 80s, that's coming. I mean, because as you know, 80, oh, well, maybe that's why I wouldn't watch something like this, because this was when I was starting to work with sort of people with AIDS and stuff.
Right.
Right.
So you just would not want to watch something this bleak?
Well, because my life was bleak.
That's true.
I mean, because I was doing counseling and yeah. I was doing primary caregiving and I was doing whatever else it would, you know, I had.
You're not going to come home and watch a show about serial killers.
Yeah, about serial killers and child abusers. And because I heard enough of that.
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh,
so I was going to come home and watch A-Team.
I gotcha. Knight Rider.
Yeah, Kevin Spacey was, but at that time, I mean, yeah, he was.
He's a magnificent performer.
At that Thank point, you. He was a he was what they all called a chicken hawk, and that was it.
Yeah. You know?
And
the thing is, he's a terrible person,
brilliant,
but a brilliant performer.
Brilliant performance. Oh, I miss him, and
he's incredible in this episode.
It's like I watch China, but it's the same thing when you watch him on Wise Guy.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I don't know when the Wise Guy one was done, but clean slate, his performance here.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, you just can't.
It's captivating. Like it's amazing watching him. He's incredible in this part.
So sorry for him. And then Tony, who wants to kill him.
Yeah.
Oh. You know, and then Tony has to watches this.
So I guess we should explain the premise of the episode. A man is blowing up random things in a city, Seattle, I think.
Yeah.
It has to be Seattle because, again, they're shooting in Vancouver.
Yeah.
They is blowing up things in Seattle, and they need to go and catch him. And unfortunately, Tony's goddaughter is caught up in one of the explosions. She's not killed, but she is injured. And in fact, the guy goes so far as to write an apology note to the newspaper explaining that he did not intend for anyone to get hurt, but he's trying to rid the city of filth.
Yes.
And that was one of the things. And a candy store, of all things, is one of the things he tried to blow up. And it takes them forever to figure out the significance of that.
Yeah, well, that was, but it was kind of bizarre because, first of all, they didn't originally go. It's because Tony
runs off.
Runs there because it's his goddaughter.
Yeah. Then, literally the day after he gets there, the guy blows up a cop. So, of course, the team is invited to help out.
Well, yeah, but then he can talk because David Soul makes it clear.
Yeah.
Right? We have to be invited in, and Tony goes,
okay, not going to be a problem.
I can talk, like, after the cop is killed.
Yeah, like, that's not going to be a problem getting invited in. Yeah.
Right? But it was a problem the day before.
Of course. Yeah. Because they don't want the FBI taken over.
Okay. But here you have, again, this sounds, it's the environmentalist thing.
Yeah.
Right? And you can see that. And this is, I'm sorry, but this is handled a hell of a lot better than the Criminal Minds. With the kid.
Empty Planet, yes.
Empty Planet, right? Where
yeah.
this, okay, yes, it is a distraction, you think, but then it starts to get really weird, right? And they're going, okay, how do you fit these things together?
And then, of course, it turns out it has nothing to do with environmentalism.
No, but what happened, but what's strange, and you have to remember, again, it's 89.
Yeah.
Right? So you can't like, I wouldn't have expected in 89 for them. The environmental thing is barely taking off at
that
point, you know? So, this is one case where, I mean, Kevin Spacey's performance and his, you know, his twin brother, right?
Yeah.
Oh, and then it turns out, of course, he's the only one in the family without cancer.
Yeah, and again, it's not the direct, obvious kind of child abuse that you've seen in the other episodes this week. But at the same time, like, this is a guy who has been crippled by spending his entire life taking care of people who were dying of cancer.
Yeah.
And he's not been able to live at all. Like, he hasn't been able to live in any way, shape, or form. And it grows into this resentment.
Yeah.
of everybody around who gets to have real lives and everyone who gets to be full people, and he's stuck caring for the dying. And it's, I mean, every episode of this show is pretty bleak, but this one is especially hard to watch.
Yeah, particularly here he's taking care of his brother and then his brother just dies.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and like I mean, said,
unceremonially.
Yeah.
Unceremoniously, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
He's just dead.
He's just dead. You know, and he had, you know, and he had a cigarette, and, you know, it was just, you know, and
it's
then,
tough.
And then Tony goes in, Tony's going to take care of this guy, right? And then he sees.
He's hoping to shoot the guy. We all know what Tony's looking for when he gets
there.
That's
right. Yeah. And it's made clear that he's going to go and find some way to suicide, argue suicide by cop, right?
Yeah. He's going to blow himself up. He might let a cop shoot him. He might blow himself up. He's ready to go when Tony gets there.
And then Tony just looks at him, right? And then defuses the bomb.
And then what's fascinating is, and this is maybe the best scene the show does in these four episodes, is Tony claims that he froze.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, Tony, you couldn't stop from empathizing with him.
Yeah.
When you actually saw him face to face, when you saw what drove him to this, like, you can't turn it off. You can't stop empathizing with these people. That's clearly what's going on. And David Soul suspects that's what's going on, but Tony needs to come up with an explanation that isn't, I couldn't hate him anymore. Because this guy almost killed his goddaughter.
Well, yeah, but not only that, the thing is that, you know, and the poor guy, I mean, he actually brings the little girl, the goddaughter, a teddy bear.
Yeah.
In the hospital, he goes to the hospital. And, of course, initially they're going, well, is this a threat or whatever? No, he just brought her a teddy bear because he felt so bad that she got hurt. You know, and you just...
It's crazy.
Yeah. The whole thing, right? You just want to cry.
Yeah, it's such a heartrending episode. Because, again, it's one of these episodes where... I'm not saying it's lacking a villain. He kills a cop. Like, he's not a great guy, but at the same time, you know where he's coming from, and he genuinely didn't mean harm.
Yeah.
He has just let his resentment at the world boil over to a point where it becomes a bomb. Yeah. And my favorite thing about it is the way they catch him is that they, like, all of these bomb ingredients, I remember that from a book. Like, there's a book on bombs, and it's like, and it lists a sample bomb in there, and this is, like, literally something that came right out of a book.
Yeah.
Like, a famous training manual on the subject. They're like, okay, well, who has access to that book? And it narrows their list down really, really quickly.
Yeah, well, that is the profiling that works, right? They just go, okay, so there's a book in the university library. Okay, these people took it out. Oh, okay, whoops. There you go.
Yeah.
It was pretty, yeah.
Well, technically, he didn't take it out. He had photocopied. They're like, no, the only people, he had just photocopied the pages. But the point is, it gets them to a very short list. Mm-hmm. Which, oh, God. But yeah, so... Such a rough episode, but such a good episode at the same time, largely because of Kevin Spacey's fantastic performance.
Yes, which is why, as I said, you just...
it's a tragedy.
No, I mean, the fact that some of these guys are such scumbags in many ways.
Yeah.
Because he's not the only one. I mean...
He's far from the only one.
Okay, has everybody stopped listening to Michael Jackson finally?
Well... This might finally, they're pulling that episode of The Simpsons. They're pulling the Michael Jackson episode of The Simpsons, so.
Well, it's about time. Like, because I still remember when he died. And I wrote on my Facebook feed, good riddance to bad rubbish. And you know, sort of all of these people and these other students. Well, do you really think he did it? I'm going.
Of course he did.
Of course he did it. What are you doing? And then poor Corey Feldman having to backtrack this because. For whatever reason, now.
Yeah.
Jackson had Ryan, one of the other guys, as his plaything. So he didn't need to with Corey. But Corey Feldman, like, I don't know the Corey Feldman story particularly well or anything else. I know that he's screaming about pedophilia in the
In the, yeah, the horrible way that children are treated, yes.
Well, yes, and yeah, so, and what was your first clue? Hollywood has refused to deal with any of this, but that's taking us away from Unsub.
It is.
And this.
But it's hard not to think about it when we have to deal with
Kevin Spacey.
And Kevin Spacey and all this.
And some of these, well, yeah, but I mean, Raymond Burr, Perry Mason. My
same exact thing.
God, same exact thing.
Yep.
You know, you just go and then
there's no getting away from this. That's the thing. It's like this kind of horrible behavior so like is so woven into every bit of the industry.
Yeah.
There's no escaping from it.
You know, and you have as I always said with the Polanski thing, it's always, and I know that she's explained this and that the other thing, but I'm going, you know, I don't care. My line is, as a mother, how would you let this? I kept you guys. Oh, I
pretty far from
far from this business, because this business, I was talking about this with a guy who anyway lived in Los Angeles and did some acting, and just actually a few weeks ago, and he had, and he was talking about someone, one of his students who ended up on with the three, B. Arthur,
Golden Girls,
right? And how he said you try and warn child actors that these when they're on these sets, and if they're a semi-regular or whatever, and that everything is just fine and everything is Jim Dandy and everything is wonderful, but the minute the show is over, they don't know your name.
Yeah.
And for a child, this is devastating. This is abandonment.
Yeah.
No? I hate to say it about actors, but they are terribly self-involved for the most part.
That's true. I mean, it's that kind of personality that gets drawn to that career.
Yeah. You know, because you have to, and of course they're supported in it and they're aided and abetted in their horrors. And, I don't know if anybody's watched I Am the Night. That's a six-part series with Chris Pine, and it's about another alternative to the Black Dahlia. But what a horrible! And I think it's the story. Supposedly, is based on a real story, but it must be the story that Chinatown was based on.
All right.
The movie Chinatown.
No, I figured. I didn't think you were saying Chinatown's, the concept was based on it.
No, no.
But yeah, I will have to check out I Am the Night with
Chris Pine. It's called I Am the Night, Chris Pine. Yeah. The lead actress is not very good, but
no.
That's okay. The whole story is fascinating. I have to, and apparently, and I haven't tracked all of that down, but it is based on one of these scummy. Well, all you have to do is read LA Confidential.
Yeah. If you want to know about this LA stuff.
And scum, you know.
Oof.
The people that were in and around, and how protected everybody was. Just how protected everybody was. I haven't read the guy who did the porn, the book, who was the, what did he call himself? The pimp for the stars?
I haven't heard about this.
Oh, no. He wrote a book a couple of years ago. But okay. He had come out of the military, and then he's basically set up a brothel, a secret brothel for the stars. And, of course, he names people like Katharine Hepburn and Tracy, Dick Spencer Tracy.
Spencer Tracy.
A whole bunch of other people, right?
Wow.
But it was basically for stars who were gay.
Oh my God, that's fascinating.
Yeah, you can.
Well, there's so many of them out there, but that was so endemic to the situation there. About, let's face it, it's an industry that, I mean, people are, why so many gay actors? Well, they've been training to be actors their whole life.
Yeah.
Like, you grow up in America as a gay person, closeted, you're already doing the job.
You're already, if you are successful at it, in fooling your family and everybody else, guess
around
what?
You, guess what? You're a talented actor. go to Hollywood.
Actor.
It's like that is why there's such a preponderance. It's not just that gay people, you know, tend towards the performing arts. It's that they've developed those skills. They've practiced those skills their whole life to be to survive as a gay person in America. That's just a fact. So yeah, it is fascinating. But to briefly go back to the show that we're here to talk about. It's a tragedy that, you know, Kevin Spacey
was such a scumbag.
We still love his performances. We're still going to watch Wise Guy. Probably not going to watch American Beauty. But then again, American Beauty was never very good.
Well, that every time, like, it sits there, right? And I go, I've never watched it.
You shouldn't.
No, I've never watched it. The whole premise was so stupid.
Yeah, it's like a guy in midlife crisis and blah, blah, blah. I don't care.
You want to see a guy in midlife crisis?
I don't care about your journey.
No, go and watch the Coen Brothers.
Which one?
You know, the Jewish one.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, the Jewish one. That is the perfect way to describe a serious man. Yeah,
a serious man. I mean, that's the only way to describe it. And anybody who's watched, you should have watched Sheldon last night.
I will eventually. But anyway, the point is, A Serious Man is incredible, everyone should watch A Serious Man.
It is incredible, and it stars Richard Kind, one of the guys in it.
That's something we'll get to in a second. You know, Richard Kind is amazing in A Serious Man. Like, he's so good.
Ugh.
But that's actually something we haven't mentioned yet. But so before we get into the fourth episode, which there's not actually that much to talk about in the fourth episode, just because it is as much about the downsides of profiling as the upsides. It's kind of amazing. But one thing I will mention is, so in an attempt to keep the show from getting too bleak, obviously someone said, you gotta have a comic relief character in there.
Yeah.
Right? You gotta have a funny guy in there, because this show is just gonna be too depressing otherwise. So Richard Kind was obviously brought in to be the comic relief character. And here's the thing. In these first four episodes, he's basically not on the show. Like, he's in the first episode, and he gets a comedy subplot in the first episode where he does a bad job of hypnotizing someone. I'm like, this feels tonally off from the rest of the show, but maybe they know what they're doing. And then I guess that I feel like his presence on the show was mandated by someone at the network saying, you've got to lighten this up somehow.
You know what? Wait till you and the dead shall rise to condemn thee.
Okay. So apparently they use him at some point.
Well, no, just wait. Because what happens is the David Soul character, so the boss, because the rest of the team doesn't seem to understand why he's there. And
okay, you know what? We're going to talk about this next week.
We'll talk about it next week. But
there is reasons.
Yeah, he brings in the coffee and the donuts, you know?
Yeah. But the point is, it's just like, it's so strange that they explain this reason for they touch on why he's there, and then he's not there for three episodes in a row. It's very strange. Because it's like I think he's in the background and has one line in one of the episodes, and he's just flat out not in two of the episodes.
Yeah, well, as I said,
it's
just
very
wait.
Strange.
Yeah,
I know, I will wait and I will see. I'm saying it's strange to have an ensemble and then focus on one of the characters and talk about how weird it is that he's there, but then kind of offer a reason. And then to do three episodes in a row where every other character gets moments where you notice them and he's not in it at all. It plays very strangely. But you know what? I'll see going forward.
Okay, and the
fourth episode. What's that?
I think, and they swam right over the dam is the one where, okay, never mind.
This is stuff we're going to talk about next week. Yeah. So the episode Daddy Dearest.
Well, it wasn't what I expected it was going to be.
There you go. Oof. What did you expect it was going to be?
Well, no, I Daddy Dearest is the title of, what's her face's? One of her.
You're thinking of Mommy? Which one?
No. Mommy Dearest is the Joan Crawford, but.
Yes.
You know.
Joan. Yeah. Which is Daddy Dearest?
I'm just trying to think.
Is it a. Are you talking about a crime writer?
Another one of
these
Hollywood ones.
Oh, okay. It's a Hollywood one. All right. I didn't know if you were talking about.
Story of incest, you know.
Oof. Well, the incest is all subtextual this time. It is. although we would not be surprised. So yeah, the story in it is fascinating because it's an episode, as much as anything else, about how blinkered you can be if you focus on the profile.
Yeah.
Because they, because guys are getting murdered, they're getting strangled in their houses, and their genitals are getting cut off in a vicious, sexualized crime. And because they all go insane to themselves, we know all serial killers are men. They keep trying to figure out, like, were these guys secretly gay? Yeah. They keep looking for evidence that these guys are secretly gay.
Yeah.
And they're like, they're all loners. They're all isolated. All these victims are isolated loners and, let's face it, jerks. But if they're not gay, how is this guy... how is this guy getting close to them? How do they not see this guy as a threat? Does he know them? Blah, 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 blah. And it's very interesting because we find out, halfway through the episode, no, it's a woman.
Yeah.
It's a woman doing it. And then you think to yourself, okay, well, it makes sense that she would be able to get close to them. And of course, then we get the other layer, which is why she's doing it, or at least the justification she herself uses, which is kind of nice. But it's interesting because they introduce her pumping weights in a bar as part of a floor show, which is a little weird to watch.
Yeah.
Because they want to establish right away that she's super strong, which she is. But then you get a scene where she beats up a guy who's hitting on her girlfriend.
Yeah.
And I'm like, here's the thing, buddy. Why did you come to a lesbian bar to try to pick up women? This is mostly on you. I'm not, really in favor of people getting beat up in bars. But you came to a lesbian bar to hit on. What is wrong with you, pal?
Well, it was the 80s.
Okay, there you go.
People were stupid.
People were stupid back then. But yeah, and the thing is, the show is not shy about it openly being a lesbian bar.
Yeah.
Other than this one guy who gets beaten up, there are only women in that extras in that scene. Like, the show's not shy about it. The show's presenting it just as they wanted to. And I'm like, way to go, show. Not shying away from this.
Yeah. And,
Oof. It's interesting that they catch the guy, they catch her in the most traditional way, which is, well, what do these guys have in common?
Yeah.
And it takes them a while to figure out what they all have in common.
Remember, we don't have computers.
It's true.
That are not fast anymore.
It's true. Penelope would have had this done in 10 seconds.
Yes, but you can't do it in 10 seconds in 1989.
No, because what they all have in common is that they all witnessed crimes and refused to testify.
Yeah.
And it takes them a while to get there because that's not a thing that's easily searchable.
Yeah.
You can't just, like, it's not easy to pop in into a computer, here is the name of a person, show me every time they show up in police files.
Yeah.
Like, that's not something that they show up in everybody's police files. That's not something that's easy to do at this time. And I kind of love how they acknowledge that, yeah, it's harder to do because it was such an oblique way they were all linked. And then they, of course, assume it's a guy.
Yeah, of course.
They assume it's a guy.
They're looking for a male cop.
They assume they're looking for a male cop, and so they go and they find a, what do you call it? They find the guy who was the point of, the investigating officer on the first case.
Yeah.
Where the guy didn't, where the guy refused to report, like refused to be a witness, and they're thinking quite logically, and I like this, they're like, okay, well, what if he got so mad at this one guy, it allowed him to cut loose with stuff that was already inside of him, and then he couldn't stop doing it.
Yeah.
Like, they have a good narrative for how this guy could be the killer, that you can totally understand why they would assume he was the killer, because their narrative just inherently makes so much sense to them. But of course, the guy turns out to not be the guy. He doesn't react the way they expect him to. He's got an alibi. It's obviously not him. And so then we get an entertaining thing where it's like, well, the guys also had German Shepherd hair on them. They were also German Shepherd. Dog cops, the canine patrol uses German Shepherds. Is it any chance it's a canine officer? And the nurse says, no, I've dismissed all of them. The three guys aren't the right height, and the fourth one doesn't fit the profile.
Yeah, and that was what was so funny.
Like, what?
Well, she didn't fit the profile because she was a she, and they told them it was supposed to be a guy.
Yeah, and well, she says 95% chance it's a guy. And he's like, that doesn't mean you don't open her file and take a look. You can't let the profile. Yeah, this is something
that
they...
was, yeah, I mean, that was a whole interesting thing about, you know, how he deals with that with her, the profile. Yeah. Because, yeah, it's not clear. It's the profiler. Nobody's seen this show, right? What yeah. it is the Hetrick, Jennifer Hetrick character, the female who does all of this searching and the rest of it, and she doesn't look at the female.
No.
Right? And so, you know, David, and so it's trying to make that point that you cannot have blinkers when no. you're doing this job.
No, you cannot let assumptions. Like, rule it's you. Not just about the data. You can't be ruled by assumptions. There's always more going on here.
Yeah.
You can't, and that's, it's really, it's a nice thing for them to do because they point out the flaws in their own way of working within the episode. It's like the profile, and I guess that's what I liked so much about the show is fundamentally, I mean, it's a show about, a simulated, more effective version of the behavioral analysis unit because, you know, it's a fictionalized violent crimes task force. Right, a serial crimes task force where they use all of the resources, all of the knowledge of the behavioral analysis work, along with all traditional police work and forensics to solve these crimes. Whereas Criminal Minds wants to posit that the be all and the end all of crime solving is profiling.
Yeah.
Like that it's the ultimate way to solve crimes, it's the best kind of cop there is, blah, 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 blah. This show, at least in these four episodes, is much more, this is one of the tools in our arsenal.
Yeah.
Like, this is one of the weapons we have to bring to bear against this horrible threat. But we're not so blind as to think that we are infallible. Whereas, I mean, Criminal Minds is largely about how they're infallible.
Yeah. Doesn't matter how bizarre it is or how absurd.
They're always right.
They're always right and give Penelope a computer.
I know. Yes.
Penelope's got a computer and they're always right.
Yeah, problem solved.
Yeah, yeah. And this is the, as I said, and this is in the 80s. Like, it was fascinating, like, watching the opening scene where the unit gets there. And here are all of these cops all over the crime scene.
There are 30 cops wandering around the house.
And there are reporters, right?
Yeah.
And the cop who's in charge doesn't want to help.
I know.
You know, oh, that scene where
there's 30 cops and a bunch of reporters everywhere walking over everything. And then the best part is the cop is so offended that he's like, well, we're going to have to get all their fingerprints. He's like, get them out of their files. I'm like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, you're the worst.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Doesn't
yeah.
want to hear it. I love that scene.
Because what happens is here is you see the problems that they were having.
Yeah.
Like this.
With being taken seriously.
And the problems, of course, the FBI, yeah, is, I mean, the relationship between the FBI and local cops is fraught with problems at best in the United States.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's probably less so in Canada. But
I would assume so.
Partly, but, you know, because we don't have, like in Canada, we have, you know, you have all of your local forces, but you have your provincial forces and you have your federal forces, yeah. right? And they all have these different jurisdictions. And we had a murder just around, guy got chopped up and beheaded and everything. It was a Hell's Angels type thing.
Yeah,
drug situation. Related. This guy was warned not to come back and he came back. So... and it was just around the corner. Well, I tell you, that place was shuttered and closed off, and there was OPP. I mean, we're in Sault Ste. Marie, and we have our local police force. But yeah. I tell you, I mean,
when they were happy to turn this one over to the state.
There
cops.
Was that one, and then when I came home once, we don't have so many drug dealers on my street anymore. But
good to know.
They had a guy that was planning on. It looks like he was going to open a meth lab. About oh five houses God. Up from me, right? I came home from work too late. So I missed most of the excitement, except that there were cop cars on my front lawn and stuff, right? And there were the whole street was shut off.
Yeah.
So, of course, my neighbors are all sitting on their porches. We have some houses with porches in the Sioux, sitting on their porches having beer watching this go down, right?
Oh,
and you had
God.
The OPP, and they actually banged the door down. And like a scene from Sledgehammer, it turns out he was in the shower.
Oh, no.
The guy was in the shower, right?
And he couldn't hear them. Oh.
it was hilarious. I mean,
that's pretty beautiful.
Because I just saw that whole Sledgehammer episode with Sledge,
oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But anyway.
The cult leader.
The cult leader. Anyway, to get away from that, I mean, but that was, you know, but in the United States, there is that massive, and in the beginning.
There's that tension, yeah.
With the profilers, that tension was.
It was front and center.
Front and center.
All of that comes up in all of the books.
And you know what's funny, of course, in the United States too, it's because local cops are their local sheriffs and the rest of it are elected. The
yep.
FBI isn't, except for the head of, well, even the head of the FBI isn't. The attorney general is appointed politically.
Yeah.
But basically, the FBI is not an elected body, whereas it's basically, you know, you have...
Most levels, most American jurisdictions have elected sheriffs, which is, by the way, crazy.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Anyway, we don't want to get into that because Daddy Dearest was, you know, and it was. And the funny thing is that she is, they don't go, you don't get much of her sort of backstory. You get a limited amount.
We get enough.
We get enough to understand why she's so, and that they talk that she had gender identity issues.
Yeah.
Right? And that basically coming from her father.
Father trying to mold her into the son he would have preferred she been.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, we can talk about the various layers of social psychology going into that one, but it's well handled in the episode. I mean, I'm not going to say it's sensitively handled, but I think it's well handled in the episode.
1989.
For 1989, remember, it's amazing.
1989, a lot of how they handle this was rather amazing.
Really well, yeah, it's really well done because they make it clear that it's like, look, she was like destroyed by her father trying to turn her into something she wasn't.
Yeah,
and so now when she sees. This, I mean, obviously she's trying to get back at her father because all the guys she kills are notably older, right? But when she sees the, because her father, you know,
and
prescribed this kind of manliness, you have to be this kind of person. So when she sees these guys failing to help out the police and failing to stand up and say what they saw and be men, she's unmanning them.
Yes. Yeah, so it is a pretty clear episode. As I said, it's so different from what happens later on. Like you just for 1989, these were such dark episodes.
Oh God, yeah.
When I just think back.
Yeah, and again, plenty of shows could get into bleak territory now and again, but that's all this show did.
Yeah, all this show did.
All this show did was just the darkest stuff you could do. So
right from the beginning.
Right from the first episode.
Yeah.
It's fascinating in its own way. But I mean, watching this show, you totally understand why it didn't survive.
Yeah.
All right. So that's going to take us through the first four episodes. Thank you for coming on this journey with us. We're going to be back here next week for episodes 5 through 8, and then we'll offer some thoughts on the show Unsub as a whole.
Yeah. It's actually Richard Kind comes into his own in the next episode.
I cannot wait to see it, but don't tell me anymore.
I won't tell you anymore, but, and they swam over the dam and the dead shall rise to condemn thee. Deals with another issue, deals with another issue that I take serious issue with Criminal Minds for not dealing with. This deals
okay.
up front.
Don't say anymore. I'm very excited to get to this next week.
And then Burnout.
Wraps the thing up
and it is a... You could cry at the end of it. So it's
all
like,
right.
It's
perfect like, place to leave it there.
Yeah.
So perfect place to leave it there. So If you need to get in touch with us, if you have any questions, suggestions of other shows we should check out, drop that into profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. That's the email address you could reach us at. If you're listening to this via iTunes, be sure to leave a review, because that is how people find the show on iTunes. It's what shows are well reviewed or badly reviewed. Honestly, they just care if you're interacting. I don't understand it myself, but they just care if people are interacting it, whether they love it or they hate it. But that's the way it actually works. So be sure to do that. We will see you back here next week for the rest of Unsub. If you're watching along, we're going to once again put a link to the Primetime Crime Collection, which has all 8 episodes of Unsub in it, in the show notes on Podbean. So if you want to watch it yourself, that is currently available from Amazon. How much is it?
About $55.
Okay. So well, it's got all of this, and it's got a ton of other shows too.
It's
40 hours.
Yeah. 43 hours and like 28 minutes.
Some crazy number. Like
yeah.
That. So yeah, there's plenty of television on there. There's a couple of full shows that were half season shows or quarter season shows like this or Palace Guard. And then of course there's the pilot episode of a bunch of his popular shows. So yeah, it's definitely an interesting thing. So we'll see you back here next week. But until then, au revoir.
Good night.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.